There are interesting people in disc golf, and there are boring people in disc golf. Here's one of each on the Fish Golf Broadcast. On this episode of the Fish Golf Broadcast, someone took a time out of their busy bulls watching schedule to talk about possibly their third favorite sport. I'm here with VP of Media for the Disc Golf Pro Tour and secretly one of the most important people in disc golf media, even if he doesn't want to say it, Mahmoud Bahrani. Mahmoud, what you thinking about?
Right now, I'm thinking about the workout that my kiddos just did. I help coach a cross-country team down in Chicago, so I just got back from practice, and it's a snowy, very cold day in Chicago. So the track was actually frozen over. So we had to improvise a little bit, and we ended up doing like sprints through the hallways of Mather High School. So it was a very interesting practice, and we got the state meet this weekend. So
what kind of expectations do they have or do you have?
Unfortunately, we didn't make it down as a team. Our goal was to make it down to the state meet as a team. We still got the two kids that got down are very, very good individually. That's how they qualified as individuals. So one of the kids, we're hoping that he can be in the top 10 or so. And the other kid, if he can be all state, which is the top 25, would be a huge accomplishment. Illinois is where I'm at, is probably the, if it's not the most competitive state for cross country, it's in the top three. So
historically, yeah. It always has been. Like I remember, so I ran cross country in high school, and I had the kind of like old school coach who would have us running like 30 miles a week for the like high mileage kids. And, you know, a few of us got a little industrious and started like reading Daniels or Lydiard or hopping on like Let's Run or Die Set and discovering like, oh my God, there are teams that are doing 70 miles a week on their low weeks.
Yeah.
And yeah. I wonder if that's why they're all way better than we are. So like we'd press him on that and he'd be like, it doesn't matter. All you have to do is just run quality miles. We all loved him. We would have run through a brick wall for him. But like that was running in Florida circa 2003 to 2007 or so.
Yeah.
And at that time it was like every runner coming out of like Foot Locker Midwest was nasty and would just like wipe the floor with everyone from the Southeast.
Yeah. No, we take a lot of pride in it, I think, in Illinois. Our state course is like this very, it's this magical place, Detweiler Park in Peoria, Illinois. It's so funny to tie this to disc golf. For the longest time growing up in high school, and Peoria, Illinois was this amazing, beautiful place where you would go for the state meet. It was such an accomplishment to go. I was always like, oh man, Peoria, I can't wait to go to Peoria. And then I got drawn into this world of disc golf. No, again, I love the Ledgestone. It's one of my favorite events to produce. Now it's like, oh God, we got Peoria. It's going to be the hardest weekend of the year because Ledgestone is always traditionally a very hard event to produce, even if it is very fun and very competitive. So it's just interesting that like I've grown up with Peoria being this like beautiful place in my mind. And now it's like everybody in disc golf is like, wait, you like Peoria? Why do you like Peoria? Like it's just, but yeah, that's why. It's because the state meet at Detweiler Park is a very special place. We've had the same state meet course for like, since like the 60s or 70s or something. So it's really, really cool. Me, I graduated in 2007. I could take my time and I can compare it up against anybody from 1970 on. So like, and I think someone actually did this. They compiled the list of like every single kid who had ever run a Detweiler. I forget what place I was in exactly, but.
In the three digits or something?
Oh yeah. I think I was like 700th or something. I mean, there's not a ton of people. Like I broke 1450, which I ran 1447 my senior year, which
is fast. Like this is for a 5K on a cross country course, not a fast flat track. Like
yeah,
y'all need to know this guy was good at running.
So here's the thing. So Illinois, another thing that's very unique about us, we actually don't run the 5K. We run the 3 mile, like God intended, just straight up 3 miles. So
okay, 14, I take it back. He's not that good.
Well, it's like probably like a 15.
Yeah, 15:50 or something. Yeah,
something like that. Yeah. But it is a very fast course, which is why it's so fun to run there. The first mile is basically like all downhill. The start of the Illinois State meet is just like, it's wild to watch because it's just these, it's just 300 of the best athletes in the entire state sprinting down a hill because you have to get out because after 600 meters, it's a hairpin turn. So like okay. if you're behind,
bottleneck effect.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So if you're not out in front, you get caught and then you're done. You can be, your race can be over at 600 meters because now you're fighting through people if you're behind. So like everybody's sprinting. The first quarter mile is usually like a 60 or a 61, which is like, it's for flat mile pace. Like these guys are just, you're just gunning it. People usually come through the mile in the big schools division in like 4:30 something for the first mile of a 3
yeah.
mile race.
Yeah.
And then you're just hanging on for dear life, which is what makes it so, so entertaining. It might be my favorite sporting event period. It's just so fun to watch. It's this weekend. I cannot wait to go, taking work off on Friday to drive the boys up, and then we'll see how they do. So yeah, should be fun.
That's awesome. I love the simplicity of running as a sport. Like there is no contrivance mm-hmm. to it the way that there is in disc golf.
Exactly. No, it's just this beautiful. I always tell my kids, this is the only sport where like it's a very honest sport. Because there's a lot of sports where like your coach can kind of make up a narrative about you. Like your coach could say in basketball, like, oh, this kid doesn't play that hard, or this kid, you know, I don't like his shot or whatever. They can make something up and they can say like, there's a reason I'm benching you, even if that reason might not necessarily be true. Whereas cross or track, there's no lying. There's no way for me to, if a kid runs 440, the kid ran 440. There's no way for that to be fake. So
they can lie about their training when you're not watching or something, but like those results are going to be real obvious.
Yeah. I don't know. I really enjoy it. It's been a part of my life since I was, gosh, in the sixth grade. You know, I did take a big break after college. That's where disc golf kind of came in, because after college I was like so mentally like devastated, I guess. Like, I don't know. I had a pretty rough college career relative to my high school career. So when I got out of college and I was all region a few times, and I think I'm like fifth on a all time in the steeplechase and 10th all time in the 10K at UChicago. But like, I wasn't an All-American. I didn't get to the national meet. I was like, so it was heartbreaking for me. So after I graduated college, it was like, okay, I need to take a break from this just mentally. And I was like, what's another thing I can do outside for an hour and a half, 2 hours that is very rhythmic, very kind of mentally calming, I suppose, and very like kind of repetitive, simple, a simple thing that you're just trying to do over and over again and get really, really good at. Disc golf just trying to check all those boxes, especially when I moved to Connecticut. I didn't know anybody, didn't know what to do, you know, as like, and then there's this beautiful course, Page Park, 3 minutes from my house. And it's a beginner friendly course. I could go drive down there and play around in 45 minutes and be done in no time, go get to work on time. So like disc golf kind of filled that void for me when I knew I couldn't run the same way. I was running 100 miles a week in college, and like, I just couldn't like emotion, like physically I could have kept on going, but like mentally, emotionally, I wasn't there. So
doing a little bit of back of the envelope math, even if you're running 6 minutes a mile average, that's 10 hours a week that you're just running, let alone all of the other training stuff to do. Like it's hard to sustain that when all of a sudden you have a real job, not a college type job.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I mean, the same is kind of true for the like regional disc golf pro, I guess, who's being a weekend warrior, grinding it out for, you know, 30, 35 tournaments a year on top of a 40 hour a week job. Real quick, can you share what you were doing for your job while you were in Connecticut?
Yeah. So I was working at ESPN. I was, and you kind of work your way up. I started as a PA, mostly working on NBA stuff while I was there. Probably like the first year, I was working on like SportsCenter, just kind of whatever they put me on, NFL Live. But after about a year and a half, I was pretty focused on NBA stuff. So I worked on NBA Tonight, which was a show at like 2 a.m. that no one watched. but it was with people that are, oh, sorry, go ahead. Yeah.
That's a tough hour to be competitive in ratings.
I mean, we were really, really targeting the West Coast there, like the late night West Coast. But, you know, we had people on the show who are now famous, who at that time were not famous. So that's cool. Like Cassidy Hubbard, who's now like, either she's like, I think the B sideline reporter for ESPN behind Lisa Salter. So she's like, she's done very well for herself. We had Ryan Russillo on the show, who has a very popular podcast. Tim Legler was on the show a lot. Got to work with Chauncey Billups a few times, which is cool. So yeah, it was great. It was a great experience working on that show. That show eventually got canceled and got kind of turned into The Jump with Rachel Nichols. So Rachel was my boss for 2-3 years working on that show, which I really, really enjoyed. But the show was all out in LA, but a lot of the production happened in Connecticut. Once that show kind of, so I actually left before that show got taken off the air. I left to kind of move to New York with my wife. So yeah, sorry. I think I answered your question, but then unanswered it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, all right. Here's the secret to all of the, you know, 20-year-olds out there. You've got this idea of what you're going to do in your life. And it's a very linear, straightforward thing. And then like, by the time you're 34 or so, you're going to have had several jobs that are disconnected to everything you thought you were going to do. And you're going to wonder exactly how you got here. But like in general, it's all kind of, it's going to be fine. Every single job you have, whether that's like waiting tables or cleaning trash cans or whatever, like all of those can teach you some valuable skill, even if the job sucked in the interim. So Mahmood, now you are, as I noted, the VP of media for Disc Golf Pro Tour and also the lead producer for the Disc Golf Network live broadcasts.
Yes. Yeah. That I would say is like, that's at least what I like to say is my main job, I guess. Like that's my favorite part of my job is when we're in it, when we have a tournament going on and it's me and my coworkers all working really hard to bring you guys the live broadcast. Make it as entertaining as it can possibly be.
Yeah. And it was a very, very full slate of tournaments this year. Like, do you remember how many broadcasts or how many rounds y'all did in total?
Yeah. So it was 31 tournaments. I know, cause I check them off the list every time we get done with one. It's 31 tournament weekends. You know, we did the math. If you do the rough back of the envelope math, it's 3 rounds a weekend, roughly. It's obviously more than that because Worlds is 5, some are 4. That it's 4 hours each broadcast, which again, it's probably more than that for some of them. It comes out to approximately like 960 some odd hours or something. So it's like close to 1,000 hours of broadcasting between me and the rest of my team. It's a pretty good value, I'd say, for how much you pay for it. But it's a lot of hours of content, and but like it's fun. I guess it's fun when you're in it. It goes by really quick.
I guess something that's interesting to me about your career path is a lot of the other media entities were people who were into disc golf and kind of got into like photography or videography. Mm-hmm. Or like the commentators, they just were players who were asked to do that.
Yeah.
It seems like you're one of the few people who have a very professional resume and background in sports media. Do you feel like that has lent you a good context for like where we've been, where we're going, and like how to like borrow good things from, say, ESPN's strategies?
That's a super interesting question. You know, I think the interesting thing about ESPN is that it's so big that you're often not like, I'm doing so much more now than I ever was at ESPN. That provided a good basic structure, I suppose. But like, I still had to, it's not, I don't want to make it sound like I came in from ESPN. Oh, here's all these things I know from this other spot. And now I'm going to implement them into disc golf. It was more so that like, I still had to learn on the fly. I still had to kind of create everything or create those workflows based on kind of what I was seeing and what we had to work with at the time. It certainly helped having the background of media, because I knew like, here are these base things, here are these like low hanging fruit, these are like the easiest thing. Like, that's why I was so excited when we started, because I was like, it would be so easy just to get to like this baseline level, and we're not even close. There's so many like little things that are so easy to do, but I still had to like figure out how to do those things given the kind of system that we're working with. Because like at ESPN, every single thing, there's someone doing it for you. Like there's so few things that, like, for example, if I wanted a transition, like a custom transition, I would go to a little spreadsheet and I would type in, I need a Albert Pujols, let's just say, Cardinals transition for SportsCenter. And they would fire it up. They put it through the machine. They send it to me and I'd be like, all right, cool. I didn't really do anything there, right? All I did was like say that I needed an Albert Pujols transition. That didn't take any actual technical knowledge or ability or anything other than knowing that I need that transition for my highlight. While that background was super helpful, all the technical stuff that I had to, all that learning, like most of it came from being here at DGN, where we had kind of to build it up from the ground floor. I do want to just say, like, you know, without Johnny Van Derzen, without Gary Obenberger, Jeff Tosi, Ian Lunger, like Nick Markey, David Nelson, none of this stuff would really be possible. And especially JVD is kind of like the godfather of kind of the back end of all disc golf media. Like the things that he's invented to allow us to do our jobs as efficiently as we're doing them is really, really cool. We're all pretty indebted to him.
Yeah. That's all great. And like you probably just name dropped 6 or 7 people that a lot of Disc Golf Network subscribers have never heard of and have no idea how essential they are to the entire operation. They see the commentators in the booth and they holler about the commentators in the booth, or that, you know, this replay wasn't on time, or that like this is a shaky cam. Y'all are doing a ludicrous amount and have improved a ludicrous amount over the last 3 or 4 years without the overhead and specialization that ESPN has been able to. So in your current role, I'm sure that you have to do some off-season planning to figure out more ways or invent new things or new jobs that can improve the state of Disc Golf Network for future subscribers and future broadcasts. Without divulging too much, like, what does your off-season look like? What does your off-season from the disc golf season look like? Because, like, you have to continue working on this stuff.
I mean, it probably started the day after the Tour Championship. It was just like, all right, let's go. Like, it's pretty much immediate.
And do you have to schedule meetings, and how icky does that make you feel?
So I think you're referencing several tweets I've made that I'm very anti-meeting just as a concept. I think there's a lot of science showing that they're not like super effective. We have to do a lot of meetings, a lot of conversations, a lot of like, let's figure out this thing that, you know, was perpetually, maybe could have been more efficient. Let's figure it out. Now, what I think is cool about the fact that we do so many broadcasts, like we do way more broadcasts relative to like any other sport or whatever. Maybe baseball is the only example of a thing that does like a similar number where they're just going every day. But we do so many broadcasts that we get really efficient really quick, because we couldn't be we have to be that efficient, because if we're not, we're gonna die really quick. Like, we can't do stuff that's like, you figure out very quickly what is like necessary to do to really improve the broadcast and what is not necessary, and as soon as you find out that something's not necessary, you stop doing it.
Can you give an example of a feature or something that has been cut because it wasn't useful?
When we started DGN, or this version of DGN, I guess, it was me alone in JVD's basement, like literally in his house, in his basement of his house in Milwaukee. Gary Obenberger would come over, run graphics, JVD would direct, and I would produce. I would, so the broadcast would be over and Gary would go home, and I would stay up and make, I don't know how many graphics. I would probably make like 10 to 20 graphics, because our cameras all have to move every single time, right? Like, they're all guys on with legs. And before we had enough cameras where we could cut around the course, I needed a way to move cameras each time. Like let's say we're on a par 4 and the catch cam has caught the last disc. He needs to hear the deck operator, he or she needs to move before the A cam gets to that spot. So I need to make a graphic. I need to make something.
Basically. Your options are like run the flyover, cut to booth, or flash something on the screen that, you know, is talking about the difficulty of this hole or how Paul McBeth is doing right now or something.
Exactly. So like, I used to make so many things. So I used to cut up a ton of sound bites. I used to have like so many things so that it would feel like this isn't just me filling time. Like, here's an interesting stat. Here's this Paul Macbeth thing that's really cool because Paul Macbeth just threw a great shot. Here's the soundbite, what he said about this hole like 2 days ago. That stuff, we don't do that very much anymore. That's a combination of like, I don't think I'd be physically able to do that anymore because I was staying up till midnight or 1 a.m. each day just working on stuff. And also, we just have so many more tools in our toolbox now. We have, like you said, we have the flyovers available. We have the, you know, we have a variety of cameras to go to, which are more interesting than just catch or throw. We can go to the drone. We can go to the gimbal. We can replay things a lot more. That's something we've gotten a lot better at, is like, that shot was awesome. Let's see it again. And let's not just see that shot again. Let's see the player's reaction. I still make a handful of like custom graphics. And we have production assistants now who I can say, like, make me, like, I think a great example of this, Eliezra Middling from the Throw Pink Championship, one of the breakout stars of that event. She was so fun to watch. After day one, I think day one, she eagled a hole 18. It was incredible. And I told them I just want hole 18. I just want her playing hole 18. So then when we get back to hole 18 the next day, I can say, hey, remember what Eliezra did yesterday? Let's see if she does it again, right? Just stuff to cue the viewer. A very obvious example of this, to go a little bit further back, is, and I think this is informative because so much of what we do doesn't see the screen, the Katrina Worlds, I think it was 2021. Going into hole 18, Paige had really struggled that hole the entire tournament. I think she had played it like 2 over par, whereas Katrina had played it 1 under par. We put together a kind of a highlight package, or I guess low light package, or whatever you want to call it, of Paige really struggling on that hole. So like after the highlight package, we went to a graphic, showing the raw numbers showing that Katrina's way better at hole 18 than Paige Pierce. Now we go into hole 18.
You make that not knowing how the rest of the round is going to go. Like, you might have done all that work for nothing.
Exactly.
But in case it's relevant and the tournament is within 2 strokes.
Which it was. And that's when it's really cool. I want to say like 75% of the stuff we make doesn't see air. There's so much stuff that you work on where it's like, maybe that'd be cool, but like it doesn't see air. You know, I think if there's anything that ESPN taught me, it's that part of it, that I think a lot of people that come into this from the disc golf side, but not necessarily the media side, are almost offended by, or not offended is the wrong, maybe a too strong word, but just that's hard for people to process. You might work really, really hard and do a really, really cool thing, and it might not see the light of day if it doesn't work for the betterment of the show.
Real quick, that's another dirty little secret to 20-year-old listeners, that like, you can work really fucking hard at something on your job and it might get cut, or they might pivot before it gets to anywhere close to showing.
Exactly. Like, and you just get used to it. Like, you're almost desensitized to it. Like, I've seen entire segments be floated where it's just like, yeah, you don't get to do your cool package. I worked on the WNBA playoffs in 2016. That was one of those sick playoffs where the Sparks and the Lynx played that epic Game 5. So that was really exciting. I put together all kinds of packages, like Maya Moore packages, Candace Parker packages. And I think like one of them saw air. And especially in the game, when you're actually in the show, putting together packages in real time, by the time the thing is put together, Candace Parker might have scored 7 points in a row, and now your Maya Moore package is irrelevant. And it just happens so quick, and you just have to be like, you have to be okay with it. That's a hard thing, I think, for a lot of folks to process, where they almost feel like get upset when they work on something and then it doesn't work out for them. But yeah, I think that the adaptability and being able to be fluid is what we're pretty good at for the most part.
Sure. Do you think, as assuming Disc Golf Network is able to continue gaining subscribers and scale up, is having more of those like interludes or packages something that y'all want to do to enhance the broadcast?
That's really interesting.
Or do you feel like you're at the right balance of that right now?
I think for the most part, we're in a pretty good spot. We've gotten to the point where I really like our control room setup right now. We have like kind of a core group of 5 people. We have a director, a producer, like an A1/AD, a replay operator, and a graphics operator. I think those 5 positions, I feel really good about how that's set up. If we were going to add stuff, I would probably add cameras, replay operators and graphics operators before I would add like extra edit capabilities to be able to put together packages. Mm-hmm. Packages are great, but they're not golf. And those things go kind of by the wayside really quick. Your This Side of Heaven package with Brad Peets is like that becomes irrelevant really quick when James Conrad shooting 17. You know what I mean? Like it's, oh yes, the This Side of Heaven is lovely and beautiful, but I'd rather watch James Conrad shoot 17. You know?
Yeah.
I've always kind of been of the opinion, my producing style is such that it's like how I like to produce is I like to get out of the way as much as possible. You don't want to be seen. The best producing is subtle and such that the viewer doesn't know that you're there. And to me, that means in disc golf terms that we kind of get out of the way of the golf as much as possible. And we try and keep it cohesive, but we try and get out of the way of the great golf that's being played. And you guys, you know, you give us plenty of highlights. So it's not like we're hurting for highlights a lot of the time. I just want to have more cameras on the course. It's like, I can't explain it. It's like a hit. Like I don't do drugs, but I imagine that's what it feels like when you just have like, I see 7 cameras at once right now. And the only thing I want is more cameras. Like I
just like static cameras at every green or behind every tee pad or something like that.
Yeah. That's all I want. I just want people in my ear telling me, hey, I got a thing on here. I got a birdie on hole 5. I got an ace on hole 6. I got a birdie on hole 14. that's what I want. Like, that's not what it is right now. I keep track of the third card. Usually we have a replay operator keeping track of the second card. And then everyone kind of collectively keeps track of the lead card. We have an additional replay operator who is letting us know like, hey, on hole 16, someone just nailed the island on hole 16 or something like that.
Yeah.
So, and they're just feeding that information in my ear. And I get so excited whenever someone tells me that I have something, cause it's always really exciting. I remember when, we were doing DDO Worlds or whatever, Emporia Worlds. And, our replay operator, her name's Caitlin. She's amazing. She gets in my ear and she's like, I got an ace on hole 16, Gavin Rathbun. And you know me, I'm just like, I'm an Illinois boy at heart. So like,
right?
When you're telling me my Illinois brethren out here is hitting an ace on like this iconic island hole, I couldn't wait to show that. Yeah. So like, those are the things that get me jazzed. It's like when someone does something really, really cool. And it's like, how can we celebrate that? Cause I think at the end of the day, I just like love sports. I don't know that I love like disc golf necessarily as much as I love sports generally.
Yeah.
And sure. I love seeing people do cool things.
I'm Missy Gannon, and I listen to the Fish Golf Broadcast while I practice putt left-handed.
I'm Nate Perkins, and I listen to the Fish Golf Broadcast while I condition my hair.
If you like where this show is headed, stick around for part 2. We'll never barrage you with 11 minutes of droning external ads to start the show. So please support the Fish Golf Broadcast by visiting discgolfbra.com for hats and other apparel. Fish stamp discs are available at fishdiscgolf.com and daddydiscgolf.com, and you can save 10% on upperparkdiscgolf.com with the code Andrew10 on backpacks and other items. And now, more lies and outrageous claims from our guest, met with calm reason by Fish.
Eliezer is doing amazing stuff at Thrill Pink. That was my favorite storyline. I probably hammered that way too hard. When Caroline Henderson was like amazing at the end of the year. I love, oh man, there's this new player. It's like a new toy to play with almost. Like it's like, let's see what this person can do. Like it gets me so hyped. Yeah.
That you're hoping that pans out, as is, you know, the Pro Tour and their sponsors and the player themselves. It gets a little awkward when like Caroline Henderson didn't do a whole lot after the first couple months, you know, in part because of injury. I guess in some ways it can be tough to look back and be like, oh, we missed the boat on that one a little bit.
Yes and no, because like we want to celebrate these new players because we want people to know about them. I always jokingly say in our control room, like we're in the star building business. Like people know Caroline Henderson's name now, and but even that, you know that she had a bad season. even that is important for us because now that's a thread. Now she comes back next year. Maybe she even places 20th, 15th, 10th, whatever.
Sure.
But like we established her as a character in this narrative. So
yeah, like now there's the bounce back potential or second full year on tour. Now you're going to figure it out.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And you know, even to use a more prominent example, I don't think we are always trying to build up players or we're always trying to get people excited about players. No one's probably more frustrated other than Holland Hanley. No one's more frustrated about Holland Hanley's play than me. Like, cause like I would watch her play and I'd be like, I just need you to be a star. I need you so badly. You're so close. Just
all the pieces are there.
All the pieces are there. Please, please Holland. And she would just like mess up over and over, like these small things. And it's just like, it drives you insane. Cause I want to be able to celebrate her. I want to say like, hey viewer, Holland Hanley's amazing. Let's go nuts. But like, you can't do it if she's not giving you the thing. And she's one of those people, cause you guys don't watch every shot. Like I see every single shot, right? Me and Gary Obenberger, who's my replay operator, we probably watch more disc golf than like any person in the world. Cause we're watching three cards simultaneously and we see every single shot.
And 900 hours worth of broadcast was your estimate.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And obviously I don't do all 900 hours, but like, it's a lot. It's a lot of hours. And so I feel like I know more intimately than perhaps anyone the trends and the eccentricities of certain players. I could probably look at a player and within 2 seconds say like, oh gosh, Holland's going to mess the shot up. And then she would mess it up. And it was just like, it would break my heart every time because you can see it like before it happens. Or Owen's going to make this, be ready for this replay on camera 7, I'm going to get it from camera 5, or that's not a good example because 7's the drone, but like, you know, in any case, it would be like, you can tell Owen's going to make that putt because that just looks like a putt that Owen's going to make, or, you know, it's just, you get into a rhythm with the players in a really cool way. Like when we're all really grooving and when we're all like in our, all five of us in the control room are all like kind of operating, it's just like, we're not even talking. Well, we are talking obviously the whole time, but like, we're kind of just all flowing together with the players almost. It's really, it's almost like you're performing yourself. Like you're also an athlete, which is maybe why I like it. Cause it reminds me of being an athlete.
Yeah. And certainly disc golfer or pro disc golfers have a very symbiotic relationship with the media. Like we collectively wouldn't have contracts or marketability without, you know, the Joe Mezes, the gatekeepers, the ace runs, the par saves, the DGN that is, like, at this point, pretty clearly Disc Golf Pro Tour is putting a lot of resources into centralizing their media control and prioritizing the live broadcast. Over the last, say, 10 years or so, do you feel like that's a net positive or negative that all of this media is being centralized rather than, you know, kind of having the like, small channels just kind of pop up and do their thing?
You know, it's interesting. I've always looked at all this stuff as like complementary rather than, I looked at them as complements, not substitutes, right? Us doing our live broadcast should not preclude you from watching Jomez or watching Gatekeeper or whatever. If anything, it should supplement that. Like I think the example I always use is like, you know, I watch somewhere in between 2 and 5 hours of basketball every night. I love basketball. It's my favorite sport. So I'll watch the early game and I'll watch the late game. I'll still go the next morning and listen to like 3 basketball podcasts. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't make any sense. Like, I watch the games. I should have my own opinions about it, but I still care about what like Zach Lowe has to say about the James Harden trade. Or so I think in the same way, like, you can watch the live broadcast. I don't expect people always say like, it's so long. I don't expect anybody to sit there and watch 5 hours of live disc golf. Like, I expect you to, like, turn it on, put it on the background, maybe watch it for 10 minutes. Like, that's all I watch a lot of golf. I actively watch probably 10 minutes of a golf broadcast. I'm not expecting a lot of active watching. What I am hoping is that you see some cool stuff and you're like, oh, I wonder what Germ is going to say about that. I wonder what Fish is going to say about that on Gatekeeper. I want to hear Yuli's opinion on that shot. So like, then you go back and watch the Jomez because it's like just a different perspective. In the same way, like, I can form my own opinion on the Harden trade, but I care about what Zach Lowe's opinion is because he's smarter than me. He knows more about basketball than I do. And you're a lot smarter than a lot of folks about disc golf. So hopefully they'll tune into Gatekeeper so I can find out what your opinion is on a thing.
It can also just be that maybe a couple of those guys on the chase card weren't shooting great that day. But like, that doesn't mean that they're not still interesting, compelling players and narratives. Like, I think it's really important to preserve that kind of focused coverage. And obviously you having more cameras would allow that. Or if you had more replay operators, you could just basically have continuous disc golf shots instead of showing folks walking down the fairway until like the field is becoming a little more clear.
I mean, that's interesting. We try to keep it relatively focused. I've found in my experience of like both producing and watching that it kind of gets hard to keep track of more than like 7 or 8 players at any one time. We try and keep our broadcast relatively focused where we're not trying to show every single person, every single shot. Like we actively don't want to do that because then it's almost hard to kind of like, you'll notice when you watch a golf broadcast, like they don't cover the field. They cover like 6 players essentially. And they filter in with like, here's a great chip in from this player. Here's a great putt from this player.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how we approach our broadcast as well. Like we're usually in that like 7, 8, range, and then we'll filter in with other good shots. So yeah, I mean, we're not trying to show every player. We're not trying to show every shot from every player, especially if they're not having a rough round. Like we'll even start cutting them from the lead card. We did that at Worlds. I forget who it was. I think it was Grady Hsu. Was having just a really rough go of it at Brewster, and I think it was like hole 5. It was just like clear he was gonna have a rough day, and we just stopped showing him.
Mm-hmm.
We have a very limited amount of real estate to show shots, like between the commercials, between, you know, all the golf of all the relevant players that we have to show. It's actually surprisingly difficult to fit all that in. So like we take all the time back we can get. So like cutting one player shots is actually super valuable for us. But then if you wanted to see every single one of Grady's shots, you absolutely could. You could go watch it on Jomez.
Yeah.
So there's definitely like a lot of value to that.
So y'all filmed 31 tournaments this year, which all have multiple rounds and multiple divisions in them, or almost all of them multiple divisions. Do you feel like at some point the media landscape becomes too saturated? For myself, I used to just devour all of the McFly So High and Disc Golf Monthly and then Central Coast when that was the only things that were out there. And then like I'd start just not watching some videos unless like somebody I knew was in it. And now literally the only disc golf I watch is when I'm commentating over a Gatekeeper round. Like I don't watch anymore because it's either like I want to stay on top of all of it or no, I can't do it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you think that Disc Golf Network films too much or the right amount or not enough?
Well, yeah, that's a great question. I think I'll answer that two different ways. So the first thing, you know, as the sport progresses, you're 100% right. We're not expecting folks to watch every single weekend. Like that's obviously like, that's a lot. Maybe you put it up every single weekend, but you're not watching. That's fine. I think just like you don't know the Genesis Invitational is going on, but you probably know when the Masters is going on, right?
Only because it's inconvenient to my other travel.
Because it's like right in that Georgia area, yeah. But in the same way, like you know the U.S. Open is going on, you know whatever is going on, the British Open. I think we'll probably start trending in that direction where it's like, okay, I had a Wilds this weekend, not my favorite course. I don't generally like this tournament. I'm probably just gonna, maybe I'll put it up, but I'm gonna kind of zone this one out. Oh, it's Worlds this weekend. All right, I'm in. I'm gonna watch. I think we're probably gonna trend in that direction. Just same way with any sport, like. You know, tonight they're like, for example, tonight's NBA. There's a couple games. I'm not this Knicks Cavs. I'm not like super interested in either of those teams. I'm not going to tune in tonight. I don't really care too much. And you kind of pick and choose what nights you are choosing to partake because there's so much. You don't have to watch every single night. But there is like something for everyone in that though. Like Knicks fans and Cavs fans are probably stoked, right? Just like in baseball, 162 games, clearly too many, but you, a baseball fan, can go watch the Braves. You're a Braves fan, right?
Correct.
Orioles? Oh, yeah. I wasn't sure if it was Braves or Orioles. So you could watch your Braves game and be really excited about the Braves going on. But someone else who's maybe a, White Sox fan doesn't have to watch all the Braves games. So
if I were a White Sox fan, I would definitely watch the Braves game instead.
I know so little about baseball, but other than the White Sox are terrible. That's like all I know is that the White Sox are bad.
And they're going to be terrible for a while. It's been a lot of own goals down on the south side.
So I heard, not to change the subject on you, because I'm going to answer this question, but I love my White Sox fandom because it's so on the periphery that I only hear the jokes, and it's just like, so it's like kind of fun in that way. Like I heard that we like hired like an old, like kind of weird guy to be the manager, but he was like super old.
Okay. You're a couple years behind, but yeah, I'll give you the history. Jerry Reinsdorf is the owner of the White Sox. Was he also the owner of the Bulls?
Okay. Yeah, so also the owner of the Bulls.
I don't know if he's mismanaging the Bulls in the same way, but it's possible.
Yes, he 100%.
Great. So he has long kind of cried poor at every turn. Mm-hmm. But he wanted to hire Tony La Russa in like the mid 80s or something. And apparently he regretted not doing it. And La Russa went on to win World Series titles with the Athletics and then later with the Cardinals. He's a baseball Hall of Famer. And at age like 78, Tony La Russa got hired someone who's not really kept up with like the modern innovations in the game. He got hired for a young roster that had like a whole lot of really young, exciting, and especially Latino players. Like La Russa, as far as I know, does speak Spanish, but like it's hard to get a whole bunch of, you know, 21, 22 year old players to get excited about this ancient guy who doesn't connect with them in the same way that, you know, some of the assistant coaches might. Right. So anyway, I think they had a window to win, but Tony La Russa, and this is perception more than like might actually be the truth, I think he turned a 96 win team into like an 89 win team.
Oh man.
For a couple years. And then eventually he had some health problems and wasn't able to go on road trips. And he has since resigned. But basically, like in baseball, you only have a certain amount of time that like your team can win. Right.
Yeah.
And
so, that's every sport. Yeah.
Yeah. It is. And some of that's dependent on like your division. Some of that is on, you know, just all of the factors. And if you don't capitalize on those and go to the playoffs or have a deep run or like show meaningful progress, you're not going to get the free agents. You're not going to get like, if you don't have a good system in place to like develop your draft picks into good minor leaguers, into good major league prospects, if there's not like a coherent strategy from top, the executive level, to bottom, it's never going to work. So anyway, like if you're a Chicago White Sox fan, you play in the arguably the worst division in baseball and your competitive window is dog shit right now. It's a real crying shame.
Well, you know, it's a good thing I paid close to no attention. This is going to make me sound like it's going to be so embarrassing that I walk around wearing a White Sox hat because I love the branding. Yeah, I don't know anybody on the White Sox roster anymore other than Dylan Cease,
who is somehow disc golfer. He's made the White Sox disc golf's home team.
Yeah, which doesn't make any sense. Yeah, it's like it's sad because the team is like Chicago. It's in the Chicago vortex of sadness right now. I think all of our teams are kind of not doing too hot, between the Bears being terrible. The Blackhawks just got Bedard, so like people are really excited. I tried watching hockey the other day. Hockey, I don't know if you know anything about hockey, because I didn't. And obviously I was in on the Blackhawks when we had Kane and Taze, and we were winning those Stanley Cups. But like they only play for like a minute at a time, and it was so tilting to me because I'm like, oh, sick, Bedard. I'm going to sit down and watch this Bedard kid everyone's been telling me about. And then 40 seconds in, and I'm like, where is he? Where'd he go? And it's like,
oh, line change.
Yeah, exactly. I texted Sam Gaddis, who's our kind of like our on-ground director, and he's like super into hockey. And he was like, oh, yeah, they only play for like 40 seconds at a time. And I was like, oh, how do I get – I want to love him. I can't love him if I don't see him. And he's like, yeah, it's like, it's really hard. And I'm like, well, okay, I guess I'm going to go back to watching like Wembanyama on the Spurs or whatever. But anyway, okay, so I got sidetracked, which is very easy to happen. The PGA Tour, to bring it back to, is it too many tournaments, media saturation? The PGA Tour, I think, plays like 44 weekends out of the year. Like, it's like every, there's like a tournament this weekend, I guarantee you. They play every weekend that isn't like Thanksgiving and like Christmas. These are PGA Tour events. It's not like they're lesser events, or for the most part, those are all just full on PGA Tour events. And maybe five of the top players will show up. Maybe it'll be like, you know what I mean? Like, it's not everybody.
Yeah.
Those tournaments are happening every weekend. They're a big deal. They celebrate each one like it's a big deal. And every tournament awards 500 FedEx Cup points, which is like the maximum amount. And no one pays attention to those. But then you get to the heart of the season. Then you get, okay, there's these like a few signature events, essentially, where they're like, okay, top players, we really want you to come to those. And everyone pays attention to those if you're like a medium golf fan. Then if you're a lesser golf fan than that, then you don't pay attention to those medium events. Now you're only paying attention to the majors, right? Not exactly the model we're taking, but it's pretty similar, where we have the DGPT Elite or the DGPT Plus, DGPT, whatever you want to call it. The events where we're telling you, hey, this one's going to be great. Everyone's going to be there. There's more stuff at stake. You know, this is like events like Ledgestone, D-Glow.
Yeah.
MVP is not a great example because it's a playoff, but like a few, Portland, for example, like these are the big events that we want you to pay attention to. If you don't want to pay attention to Jonesboro, that's your prerogative. We think Jonesboro is great. This Side of Heaven is one of my favorite courses on tour to produce, at least for TV. But if you can't make time for that one, that's okay. But please make time for Portland. And now let's say you're not even that big of a disc golf fan. Okay, please make time for the Champions Cup. Please make time for the European Open. Please make time for Worlds. Yeah. If you're not that big a fan, let's take it even one step down lower. Just pay attention to Worlds, okay? And then if you're lower than that and you don't even want to pay attention, okay, then we can't help you. Then maybe you're not a disc golf fan at that point.
You'll digest somebody's highlights where they're clipping like real media channels stuff and rehashing.
Exactly.
So yeah, I can definitely hear the similarity in PGA events that are heavily invested in versus the ones that nobody really cares about, even the players. I'd like to give you an opportunity to speak directly to the Disc Golf Pro Tour players who have complained that there are too many events and we're tired and there's just too many back-to-backs.
Yeah. There's a lot of tournaments. I mean, I don't want to take away from, like, it's a grind. It's not like, It's easy for me to say, well, look at golf. They have 40 some odd events. Yeah, but those guys fly to each event, and those guys are highly paid, very well taken care of athletes. And
they're also not playing every single one of them. They have the ability to set their schedule or have their sponsors set their schedule.
Exactly. They probably play twice a month, maybe three times a month. Whereas with disc golf, you're kind of priced into every tournament. Like, it would be disingenuous to say that, like, oh, just take that one off. Like, that's a little disingenuous, I think, because for a lot of folks, like, they need that paycheck, or they need the appearance fee from their sponsor, or they need to play a certain number of events for the sponsor, like you're saying, or they need to go to the tournament because they need to sell some discs out of their car to even have money to get to the next spot. Like, it's not everyone is Paul McBeth or Ricky Wysocki or Paige Pierce or Chris Tatar or whoever. Like, not everyone is that person. I definitely hear the complaint, the feedback that there's too many events. This is not my part of the business, quote unquote. Like, this is like, I you know, at this point I put on the show. You know, that's kind of what I like to say, is like, this is my role, is just to put on the show. I will say that, like, we hope, we aspire to get to the point where players can be more selective and make that a lot more feasible, where, yeah, okay, maybe skip the DDO or skip the whatever, the Florida Open. I'm just picking tournaments out of a hat. If that makes more sense for your schedule and that makes more sense for your health and well-being, like, that ultimately is the number one thing. I mean, I think what's really cool, what the Disc Golf Pro Tour has done really well, what Jeff has done really well, is that we've made every tournament a big enough deal that if you win that one tournament, that does enough for your career at this point. Parker Welk wins the DDO. Everybody knows Parker Welk's name now, right? He's a household name for the most part. He wins one tournament. I forget how much he won for the DDO, but it's like, I'm pretty sure it's going to be, you know, it's going to be...
It's a season maker. It means he's in the green for the year.
Exactly, exactly. Whereas that was not the case 1 year ago, 2 years ago. It's not even it's very recent history that that wasn't the case. By making each tournament as special as we have attempted to make them, it has reduced the necessity of going to each one for the most part, because if you spike one, that's so valuable. So if you playing one less tournament means you have a higher likelihood of spiking the next one, I feel like the incentives are such that the $100 you're going to get selling discs out of the back of your car is now outweighed by the potential earnings of winning a tournament. If, you know, so it's all on the margins. It's all very close. Everything is kind of, it's all shades of gray right now, which makes it very difficult. We're in this really odd nebulous space in disc golf, but I think we're trending in the right direction.
You will continue to be behind the scenes, but I'm, you know, excited to see where you're able to take the Disc Golf Network broadcasting experience for all of us. If you enjoyed this show and want to lavish praise on me, you can find me on Instagram and whatever the fuck Twitter is at fish58320. And if you hated the show and need to yell at somebody about it, Mahmood, where can folks find you?
Not on Twitter. Don't follow me on Twitter. Actively do not follow me.
It's just like weird disconnected bull stuff that is obsolete as soon as the game is over.
So my favorite thing about Twitter is tweeting a thing that makes no sense unless you're watching the thing that I'm watching at that exact moment. I love doing that because, like, out of context, I'm sure those look really funny. Where can people reach me? Gosh, I don't want them to email me, and I don't want them to reach me on Twitter. I don't have any other social media.
Schedule a meeting.
Schedule a meeting at precisely 9:02. And the meeting has, here's a pro tip for all those folks out there. Schedule your meetings on the twos and threes, like 9:02, 9:03, whatever. Please, everybody, for the sake of sanity, for the sake of all of us, start your meetings at 9:02, 9:03, end them on the sevens so people can get to their next meeting on time. So we don't have to do this whole song and dance where we have to start every meeting late and end every meeting. Everyone has to be like, oh, well, I got another one, so I got to bail. And then it's just like the whole thing is madness. I guess don't reach me is, I guess, the conclusion here.
That's terrific. And I'm delighted to say that my audience can accommodate that.
Okay, great.
All right. And if you schedule your meetings to start on twos and threes and end on seven and eights, that means there's pee breaks as well.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Which everyone needs those as well. And like food, bananas, water. There's so many things. There's so many things you need to sustain yourself.
Yep. All right. Thank you so much for your time, Mahmood.
All right. Thanks, Fish.
That's all for this episode of the Fish Golf Broadcast. But be sure to check out previous episodes and subscribe wherever fine podcasts are sold. Check out Fish Golf Broadcast hats and other apparel at discgolfbra.com and badger your friends until they listen too. Join us next time as I goad yet another guest into starting a fight with another touring player, campsite host, or toll booth attendant on the Fish Golf Broadcast. We'll be right back.